Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight on Living Mythology, I am proud to bring you the Scholars from the Edge of Time. Greetings and welcome, O Scholars. Hello?
Oh, sorry, had the mute button on. Hi, Hercules.
Okay.
How are you doing?
How are you both?
We're doing pretty good. We got a 4-day weekend coming up, although it won't be full of respite. We got a lot of projects that we're cranking out, hence a 4-day weekend. But we're doing pretty good. We'll be honest. We were giggling before this episode because we were just kind of recapping tonight's subject matter, and oh boy.
One of my favorite science fiction classics, Barbarella. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, and good evening, Hercules. You will feel inspired to chat along with us because I don't think the two of us can quite do it justice.
I think you'll do awesomely.
Well, I think to sum up so far, we've talked about Valerian, Ice Pirates, John Carter, and Yore. And Barbarella doesn't even come close to any of those films. Maybe Ice Pirates and Ambition and Yore and Psychotronica, but Barbarella, we need drugs for this film. We need lots of them. So I think the best place to start is with the plot, of course.
Okay.
So, here we go. It is the very distant future. Earth rules the universe like it should. But it doesn't rule it with a steel fist. Oh, no, no. It rules it with love and peace. Sir Duran Duran and his positronic ray have vanished into the Tau Ceti system. So the president of Earth contacts Barbarella just after she gets done undressing in zero-G to give her a mission. Track down Duran Duran, the scientist, not the band.
Well, the band was named after the scientist, I believe.
It's true.
Yeah.
So off she travels to Tau Ceti, but there's a magnetic storm, and she crash lands on a planet. She's in a rocky, icy area where she is roped by children, tied up, and robot dolls with gnashy teeth want to eat her, and they almost do. But Roman from Robot Monster saves her. Except Roman is actually just a really hairy French dude in a really hairy gorilla suit. Anyway, he looked like Roman, except no space helmet.
I was wondering, what's Roman?
The Robot Monster, it's the cheapest monster in all sci-fi. He's got a gorilla suit and a space helmet. That's his gimmick. And he comes out of the cave and goes, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, okay.
I remember
so
him.
Anyway. Bad movie. Anyway, he makes love to Barbarella, repairs her ship wrong, causing her to tunnel through the planet to the other side where her ship gets even more damaged. But she meets John Philip Law, a blind eagle who can't fly anymore.
Not an eagle. Angel.
Oh, angel. I even said angel, but eagle came out. A blind angel who can't fly anymore. But with the power of making out, he can. And he flies Barbarella to the city of Sogo while she blasts patrol ships that come in after them. In Sogo, they are, of course, captured by the Black Queen, who wants to make out with everyone. Her second in command is dun-dun-dun, Duran Duran. So, Barbarella escapes from a room with the Mathmos, which gives energy to the city, and she escapes because someone lets her out. She escapes being accosted by two lustful dudes because the Black Queen saves her. She escapes from being fed to birds because the underground resistance frees her. She escapes from Duran Duran's orgasm piano by outlasting it. And she she escapes the city of Sogo by joining the Black Queen in her escape pod. But what is not known is how Barbarella escapes from the planet she's on. And P.S. Duran Duran dies from shooting his positronic ray at folks, and the Mathmos gobbles him up. The end.
Wow.
He's scared.
Four minutes.
Well, we could go deeper, but Okay, so, okay, let's, how do you even try to tackle Barbarella? Oh, you know, okay, we'll just start from, Michelle and I, we've seen this movie a long time ago. We saw it in the late 2000s when we were both in school. You know, I was really knee-deep in my Italian film studies. And, of course, you know, Barbarella is this, you know, pop culture icon and from an Italian film. So we've got to watch it. And we did, and I don't remember the experience other than I think we enjoyed it. Or maybe
we were scratching our heads afterwards. But in either case, we forgot most of the film.
We forgot most of the film except for the infamous zero-G scene and that John Philip Law is shirtless in it. He's our peplum hero by virtue of being muscular and shirtless.
Okay.
And representative of Icarus, which is actually even stated in the song that's sung during his, what, initial appearance?
Yeah, well, but there's two peplum, no, three peplum elements in this film. So we got the mythological of John Philip Law as Pygar. I was being snarky. His real name is Pygar, who is, yeah, Icarus, and the final song references him as such. But then they're in a labyrinth, a rocky labyrinth. And what's the labyrinth from? Minotaur.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So we got...
I had David Bowie in my brain.
Well, okay. We know that the David Bowie film, which is also is pretty psychedelic, but with puppets and way more cohesive, has to be influenced by Barbarella. I mean, some of those matte painting shots of the labyrinth do look like the labyrinth in Labyrinth.
Yeah, so just as a quick segue, and then you can touch on your third element is, and I'm sure we'll get to this too, is the fact that there are so many nods and references and influences of Barbarella on pop culture over the intervening decades.
Oh, yeah.
Since it first showed. I think we'll touch on that some too, but go ahead with your third.
Well, the third one I was thinking, and I bring this up every now and then when we talk about peplum films and how, you know, peplum films are a little subversive with its sexuality. Barbarella is on the entire other end of the spectrum. It is overt with its sexuality. But what Barbarella has in common with the peplums, other than being an Italian genre film cycle, is it's women in Barbarella. They're all see-through. They're covered in not necessarily veils per se, although many of them do have veils, but like see-through clothing and the likes. And that makes me think of the belly dancers and the vamps and stuff from peplum films, because in those films, you didn't show sexy stuff. I mean, sexy time, but you showed sexy stuff by, hey, you know, let's throw a belly dancer in the throne room scene and you can see her belly and her veils and stuff like that. And I can't help but think that the women in Barbarella are kind of like that as well. I mean, yeah, there's overt, you know, sex and nudity, but I still feel like it's like their outfits are the opposite of what you would see of the era of, you know, uniforms, you know, the very, what's the Leslie Nielsen, Forbidden Planet, you know, people are in uniforms, mm-hmm. They're very dressed up. I mean, you're in space, you need a, you know, a spacesuit, but they're going the opposite way and, you know, more skin, more see-through-y things. So it makes me think of classic sword and sandal in that regard.
Yeah, and I would also say that the scene where Barbarella tries to blend in with the rest of the women,
oh, yeah.
And I think there are some men, which gives you kind of like that excess mm-hmm. kind of, you know, the leisure of the hierarchy of, you know, citizens of the city.
Ooh,
makes
ooh.
Me think of like Caligula and a lot of the other peplums where you have that amount of leisure and, you know, the woman is smoking the pipe and its essence of man and the man is in this big like tube and,
can I steal that line from you? That's really good. The leisure.
Sure.
Well, because we've talked about, like, when we watched Messalina and a whole bunch mm-hmm. of other peplum films, you have that obsequious throne room scene or courtyard scene where it's, you know, festivals and the aforementioned belly dancers and wrestling people and music and food and orgies and more food. It's very excessive. And I like that term, the leisure of the hierarchy.
I have to make a note of that.
Yeah, but I'm going to forget about it. But yeah, the hookah scene, I mean, just, you know, the hookah kind of elements is definitely, you know, Mediterranean vibes there. But yeah, so, you know, tying this back to kind of mythology and sword and sandal, sword and sorcery, sword and planet, those are kind of like the three peplum-y elements. But I would say there's also the sword and sword and planet elements. In fact, later on, there would be Dynamite put out a crossover with Barbarella and Deja Thoris from John Carter of Mars. So
I wasn't aware that they did a crossover.
You know, I think I've seen it once or twice when we've gone to Comic-Cons and just didn't really think anything of it.
Mm-hmm.
But so, yeah, they married, you know, basically two infamous women from, you know, high-profile space stuff. But so... what Barbarella is, though, it is an Italian genre film. It's part of a very short-lived cycle of films called the Cine Foodie. I'm probably saying that wrong. And it came in the later 60s. It's actually post-Euros because a lot of Italian cycles, they come in waves. You know, something comes popular, it winds down, but then another genre comes and takes its place. So, example, as the peplum started winding down, the spaghetti westerns came up. In this case, the Eurospy films, you know, their peak was in 64 and 65 after Goldfinger came out, and then the genre tapered off very, very quickly. And if people want to know more about that, you can read my essay in Michelle's book on James Bond, plug. the cinefoodie genre is kind of a successor to the Eurospy genre because they're very similar. The cinefoodie genre was it was comic book based, basically, mostly superheroes. So other famous ones that will say Barbarella would be Satanic, Criminal, and Danger of the Obelique, which a lot of people saw in Mystery Science Theater 3000. And what these films kind of had in common with, like, the Eurospy films is, for all purposes, the main character, you know, was a secret agent of sorts or a masked person. You didn't know their identity, like a secret agent. They had gadgets. They might have a secret lair. They're usually on a mission to accomplish something or perform a heist or something like that. And Barbarella, for all purposes in the film, she's a Eurospy agent. She's a secret agent. She has a mission. She's given weaponry. She's given gadgets. She's given, like, some sort of, you know, box that can translate all languages, like the Babel fish from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. A little detector when she finally meets Duran Duran. She's got a ship. You know, she travels to another place. She's got a mission. She's a Eurospy person, which is very indicative of short-lived Italian genre cycle.
Well, and I think that it also is an interesting cycle because it falls in between the peplums, the Eurospy, but also the Italian sex comedies of the 70s. So this is really kind of a natural progression of the Italian wave of cycles that are going on. The other thing about this film, I would say, is that it's also capitalizing and kind of part of the rising wave of science fiction, and that becoming very popular in the late 60s, particularly with 2001 Space Odyssey,
Star Trek,
you know, on the small screen and so forth. So it really is kind of an interesting positioned film. One of the vibes that I got from it is thinking back to some of the dialogue within it and really thinking, oh, hey, this really seems the humor was so much like Casino Royale, the David Niven version of 68, and that's because one of the script writers for this had also worked on that. So it's kind of interesting how you get a lot of these ties. You also get the ties through the various actors that were in these movies. So, for instance, John Philip Law, the fact that not only was he in Danger Diabolique, but he was also in spaghetti westerns. He was in kind of the sci-fi films. He was even in some other Mystery Science Theater 3000 spoofed films.
He was in Space Mutiny with Red Brown, who was in Your.
Yes, Six Degrees of Kevin Bacon right there.
Italian filmmaking. You brought up Italian sex comedies. I would also say the other thing that Barbarella helped kind of pave the way for is definitely loosening, you know, what could and couldn't be shown on screen. But I almost want to say the Emmanuel films, which in turn would be knocked off by the Italians, because that's what they do, with the Black Emmanuel films. And what they all kind of have in common, aside from very overt sexuality, is, you know, a lady travels to an exotic place and makes out with people. I mean, it's pretty bare bones, but there's that kind of thread between all those types of movies that Barbarella, I think, along with just kind of everything else becoming relaxed and groovy, Italian sex comedies, and so on and so forth. So I just wanted to throw that one out there to go with your Italian sex comedy reference.
That's good because, I mean, and you even talked about that in your master's thesis when you were talking about Castle Blood, because you were situating that between the different cycles that were coming through Italy.
Well, now that you're bringing that up, because, yeah, Castle Blood was one of the very early Italian films to show overt nudity. It's one of the first, especially in a horror film. But before that, you had – it's not really a cycle of films as a popular casting choice of films, but you had, for lack of better terms, the – big-breasted women genre films.
Is that a genre?
What's that?
Is that an official genre?
Well, it's not really a genre. The Italian term, I'm gonna butcher this because it's been a while since I've written about it. It's called Maggio. It basically translates to big bosom. That was era when, like, Sophia Loren's were coming in vogue, the Lola Brigott, the like, where women, not like your normal, very skinny ladies, but...
Or Jane Fonda, who wasn't, she was not big-breasted at all, so...
But in Italy, but before you started getting into overt nudity and sexuality, the closest thing you had before that was you had these dramas or comedies that Divorced Italian Style had one as well. You put a very pretty, curvy lady in the lead role. And unfortunately, I just don't have my master thesis in front of me, although you can Google it, and it talks about that term. So yeah, Barbarella happens in that kind of downward, you know, valley of between kind of depictions of women and sexuality and nudity, and it, for that alone, it's definitely avant-garde and very forward-thinking. In fact, the entire movie is very progressive, extremely progressive. I think one of the other things I want to bring up, because you were talking about Star Trek, is the handling of space in this film. Because by the time Barbarella came out, you'd already seen like either very realistic depictions of space, like with 2001, or are you seeing a more adventurous depiction of space, like in the Star Trek series? And, you know, it's, especially in Star Trek, you have the iconic image of the bridge room with the viewfinder that either showing space or, you know, put them on screen and someone else comes on. And Barbarella has a very similar screen, a scene, except that her bridge is shag carpeted.
Gold.
Gold shag carpeted.
Yes.
But her view screen, the depiction of space as she sees it, is you don't see stars and planets, or you're supposed to if you're taking acid, you see water effects, like mercury effects and like dripping in water or kind of light effects. It's very, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't want to keep using the word psychedelic, but that's really the best way to describe it, but it's very anamorphous.
Yeah, that's actually, and very fluid.
Fluid. This movie uses a lot of fluids. Like Barbarella, her spacesuit, when the visor comes down. That's not really a visor. If you look closely, it's water draining.
Yeah, it's supposed to be like a liquid mercury or something like that, which I thought was a fascinating effect. There's actually some really interesting effects in this film.
Well, we talked about how you said earlier pop culture references and this preview one. We saw a Darren Aronofsky movie 15 years ago called The Fountain.
Yeah.
And that movie also relies heavily on like trippy water effects with like close-up Mandelbrot structures. And I think Barbarella is like that. But yeah, it's just funny how the years before Barbarella, you had space going into, well, more realistic depictions of space. This is also the era where hard sci-fi was coming into vogue, the Heinlein type writing, the Clarks. But you have Barbarella not writing that wave. They're going the opposite way of here's space depicted as liquidy, anamorphous, bubbly, far out, man.
Yeah. Just thinking, too, the fact that in a way, this film kind of reminds me of Planet of the Vampires in that kind of a dreamy state, very fluid, cloudy. But it gives nods to that, which, again, is, you know, some of the Italian films. Well, and that's Mario Bava, if I remember correctly.
Seriously, there's like less than 10 space movies made in Italy. And half of them are from Antonio Margheriti, and the other two are Barbarella and Planet of the Vampires. But yeah, no, I remember when we watched Planet of the Vampires, it is very subdued. I know a lot of people, the vampires is the precursor to Alien. You know, they find like, you know, bones on a derelict spaceship and all that stuff. But I remember it being very gothic. Like that slow, creepy, oh my God, you could almost have Planet of the Vampires in black and white gothic that Mario Bava was such a proficient at doing.
You know, when you say it that way, it makes me think of like, as a comparison, the Universal monster films of the early 1930s. And then you turn around and you'd have the Hammer Horror, which would use, instead of gothic, you'd get into the Victorian era with a lot of color that would be kind of bright and less atmospheric. It's kind of interesting. And in a way, Barbarella is sort of that when you make that comparison to Planet of the Vampires.
Oh, there's an atmosphere in Barbarella, and it is far out, man. I want to use that to segue to kind of the general feel of Barbarella, because this is definitely a hippie era movie, and it's definitely a progressive film. But one of the things that Barbarella tries to, like, Barbarella the character, not the film, she's trying to say, like, the universe is at peace, but at what cost? And the example she gives is that typical kind of dystopian, you give up your humanity to, you know, find peace. So in Barbarella's literal universe, you know, people don't have sex. They take pills. They,
And here's another, we can get into the pop culture about that too.
I have a list of pill references, but you know, they take pills instead of having sex. They don't, get into a lot of emotional stuff. They're saying that stuff is archaic and barbaric. So it's supposed to be portrayed as a very sterile, future. And the only other movie I can think of kind of like that is movie Equilibrium with Christian Bale, where people, emotions are outlawed. People take their pill or their shot or whatever, I can't remember what it's called. They repress their emotions. Mm-hmm. But the movie itself has a very sterile feeling. It's a very white and gray looking palette for a film. It's very dystopian. The color is washed out of it because, you know, people don't feel emotions, so there's no art. So here's where Barbarella kind of again, zigs where it should zags. This is a future that's supposed to be sterile, but the movie itself is anything but. You can't, to me, you can't have a very sterile, dystopic, brave new world if your cockpit is made out of gold shag carpeting. There's just no way. I mean, I say that in jest, but there is some sort of crazy architectural mood that guides this film.
Yeah.
That, and maybe it's because they're on a different planet that's inhabited differently. I don't know, but the movie itself is anything but sterile. And whatever Barbarella's, you know, where she comes from, what she espouses, what she stands for, I mean, that's kind of the point of the movie, is quickly stomped on because now she's in a very colorful world, a very psychotronic world, where emotions are very frequent and rampant and sex galore.
Yeah. Well, let me read this. This is Wendy Michener's review from the Globe and the Mail. And she praises Barbarella as part of the first female sci-fi. Its shaggy gold rugs, impressionistic paintings, and spaceship were, quote, unquestionably female in design compared with any of today's projectiles. Barbarella is no man-challenging superwoman, but a sweet, soft creature who's always willing to please a man who's keen to her.
Again, that kind of points to that contrarian thing of kind of what lens you want to view feminism through, because there's different waves and different ways to view feminism.
Mm-hmm. And this is on the rise of the feminist movement of the early 70s.
Again, this movie is a paradox, I think, the best way to describe it. Because, yeah, correct. This is like one of the first, if not the first, female-fronted sci-fi films. I mean, it's coming after, you know, like having Uhura in Star Trek, which was pretty, mm-hmm. you know, progressive for its era. But Barbarella herself as a character is still a damsel in distress. Even though the movie's from her POV, she's our heroine. She's got the gun. She's got the ship. She's got the curvaceous body that theory could be a vamp and seduce people. But as I was kind of jokingly referring to in a not, you know, so subtle way, is she has to be rescued from everything. She is, like Deja Thoris, a damsel in distress all the time. It takes the hairy French guy to rescue her from the robots.
Mm-hmm.
It takes Pygar to get her out of the labyrinth. And it's not that she always has to be rescued, because, you know, other characters that happen to, like, we were talking about another comic book character that I love, but, you know, he needs to be rescued, and that's Tintin.
Mm-hmm.
Tintin always has
we were
to be
talking about that. Yeah.
But I think what makes Barbarella kind of a step back is that the course of the movie, she doesn't guide it. She doesn't make any decisions or actions that propels the narrative forward. It just happens to her.
Mm-hmm.
She happens to crash land on the correct planet that the doctor's on. She happened to be saved by the hairy French guy. She happened to just get out of the labyrinth of Pygar. She everything just kind of happens to her, and she doesn't overtly do anything. She doesn't make, like, a decision. Other people make decisions for her. Like, even when she meets the Resistance, she doesn't even have a plan to, like, get Duran Duran. It's the Resistance that, you know, proposes to her, hey, we'll give you the key to her invisible chamber of dreams if you give us your ship and your weapons. She doesn't even come up with the ideas. And it's not that, you know, she's like an airhead or a blonde, you know, so that you would see, you know, especially in the 80s and 90s cinema. It's just how she's written, that she stumbles forward. And the only other movie I can think of that we've talked about that's like that is Yor, because Yor is the same thing. He stumbles forward, leaving a trail of destruction in his wake. Well, Barbarella also leaves a trail of destruction in her wake.
Right. Now, what I would counter with that is if we go back to the beginning of the film, after she's done her iconic striptease,
mm-hmm.
she has the President of Earth dial in and tells her that she has the mission to find mm-hmm. Duran Duran. Well, they only have one picture of him, which she can't tell what he looks like.
Because he's in a space suit.
A space suit, and his face is fuzzy.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, and I distinctly remember her expression was like, how am I supposed to find this guy when you don't have any information for me? You're giving me kind of like this really difficult mission to try to find this. Now, she's definitely cued in on the fact that, oh, he has weapons.
Uh-huh.
But then that's countered because then the president sends her weapons through their transporter. And then she's given all these weapons, and she's standing there nude with all these weapons, and all I could think of was love and war.
That frame was particularly cartoony, which I think mm-hmm. was brilliant because the nudity is censored by guns. Mm-hmm. And that to me is definitely a protest painting.
Yeah.
But you're right.
Interesting given Jane Fonda. But anyway, go
for it. Yeah, like I said, universe of peace, but mm-hmm. give Barbarella weapons so she can stop another weapon. And I equated that to the plot of Plan 9 from Outer Space. Because
mm-hmm.
Plan 9, we all knew Plan 9. The driving force of the aliens invading Earth is, yo, Earth, you're eventually going to discover solarite. And when you do, you'll destroy the universe. So we're going to destroy you first. It's the, we don't want you to get a weapon, so we're going to use weapons to stop you from getting your weapon.
Mm-hmm.
a very interesting diplomatic policy there
yeah.
that Barbarella has.
Yeah, I was going to go back to the point. The only thing that she's really able to do is to do basically gumshoe detective work, and that is to ask around.
She does do that.
And she does that throughout the film. And you know, nobody seems to be able to help her. Like people have said, oh, well, I had, you know, the underground resistance. The guy had the pills.
Yeah.
You know, and she's like, well, how'd you get these? Only somebody from Earth would have these. And he's like, oh, well, I got them from the Ram. But, you know, she's doing what she can, but, you know, it isn't all on her own efforts to...
There's a lot of luck.
Yeah.
There's an extreme luck. And that's, to me, I'm going to go with you on that one because that's a mischance. Because
mm-hmm.
she should be rewarded with her detective work by progressing the story forward, not having the world react around her, because that would enable her to be a more genuine, powerful character, agency. She would
mm-hmm.
have more agency. She would be a secret agent with more agency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that's
definitely
the missed opportunity because, yeah, it's only because the guy repairs her ship bad that she tunnels through the planet, winds up in the labyrinth, and, you know, everything just happens to luckily line up, or unluckily if you think about it, because she's always captured, she's always tortured or bit. Her extremely non-existent and lacy clothes become even more non-existent and torn as the movie progresses. How many outfits does she go through?
Oh, I think at least 8.
There's a lot of outfits.
There are a lot. I want to read a quote from the director, Roger Vadim. He expressed admiration for comics, particularly Charles Schulz Peanuts, so go from Peanuts to Barbarella, saying that he liked the wild humor and impossible exaggeration of comic strips. And then he wanted to do something in that style in his film Barbarella. And he basically, you know, saw the film as a chance to depict a new futuristic morality. Barbarella has no guilt about her body. I wanted to make something beautiful out of eroticism. And, of course, at the time, he and Jane Fonda were actually married. So he goes on to say, with regards to the science fiction, you know, as we talked about earlier, the fact that the sci-fi genre was picking up pace in popularity, he says, in science fiction, technology is everything. The characters are so boring, they have no physiology. I wanted to do this film as though I had arrived on a strange planet with my camera directly on my shoulder, as though I was a reporting doing a newsreel.
I will say this. No expense was spared on these sets. And these sets are definitely designed by a madman. But the comic book feeling is definitely in this film. Because I could see, you know, we haven't read the original comic book, but, you know, it's a lot easier to depict crazy architecture, psychedelic covers, mm-hmm. weird spaceships on paper as a comic book than you would in a film because, you know, budget reasons or mm-hmm. practical reasons. But I will say this for Barbara. I feel like I'm talking bad about the film. I'm not talking bad about it. It's just so out there. You can't have but commentary on it. But it feels like a living comic book. There were frames in the film that I thought you could freeze it and put a speech bubble right next to Jane Fonda's head. And at times, because there's all these close-ups of her face, I always felt like different style of comic, but like it was one step away from being converted to a Roy Lichtenstein painting.
Yeah, and wasn't there a comic book format where they used actual images from
yeah.
movies that the Italians did?
Yeah, I don't remember the actual term for it, but yeah, what they would do is they would take frames from the film
mm-hmm.
and they would put speech bubbles and font bubbles on it and sell that as mm-hmm. a film itself. And I could totally imagine Barbarella getting that treatment.
Yeah, well, and there's an over-the-top feeling, I think, about comic book movies, you know, that we see today, you know, that makes it kind of surreal and yet also kind of something that we can still identify with.
Well, can we though? I say that because if you right now today, if mm-hmm. you say, give me a comic book film, 99% of people are going to come back and think of either current state MCU or
mm-hmm.
current state DC comics. Does anything made in the last 10 years that's either from Marvel or DC? I don't think people could even think of a movie like Barbarella now, let alone that it came from a comic book.
No, but I do think that there are, like you said, images that you thought could be a Lichtenstein, you know, print. But I think that there were definite images throughout the movie that could be comic book looking.
Yes.
And I actually was thinking immediately of The Watchmen,
mm-hmm.
for me anyway. I did want to mention that John Philip Law was also avid in comic book reader since childhood. And apparently, which will thrill DC enthusiasts, he studied the DC Comics character Hawkman for his inspiration for Pygar.
So I think one of the things, still on the subject of pop culture here, because Hawkeye is definitely pop culture, is going back to what you brought up very early in the show, is what is the pop culture imprint of Barbarella? Because there is a huge pop culture imprint of Barbarella.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the big influences Barbarella has, it's probably not unique to Barbarella, it's probably dystopian fiction that came before, like Brave New World with its drugs, and it's probably Brave New World, but Barbarella, there's this emphasis on pills. You know, she
mm-hmm.
they procreate with pills. They don't even procreate. They just,
she mentions that that they only the poor,
yeah,
that can't afford the psychocardiograms and the pills will engage in sex. So otherwise, sex is considered to be a distracting and inefficient.
But you know, side note, you brought up earlier the leisure of the hierarchy, but you know what's more leisurely than you know
a lot of excess.
A lot of excess. But
yeah.
Here she is saying, you know, it's the low class people. You side note, you would think in this utopian, I'm going to say utopian future here, there won't even be poor people. You know, it's that classic thing of, you know, why is Picard bald? Well, in the
mm-hmm.
future, no one's going to care if you have hair or not. You know, in the Star Trek, you know, universe, there really isn't
mm-hmm.
poverty or anything. So it's kind of funny that Barbarella is so in the distant future and they're so sterile, but there's still a class of lower-class folk.
Yeah, and I mean, we see that in Sogo
mm-hmm.
because of how do they refer to the people that are outside of the city? Are they the children of Sogo?
Something like that. But they have have a hierarchy because they are into emotions, and that's that natural hierarchy of the rich get richer, poor get poorer, prisoners get sent to the
Well, library. And yeah, and you see all of them, and that there's still aspects of the eroticism even at that level.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah, everyone in the labyrinth is definitely almost as nude as you can get.
But they're also contained, and that's one of the scenes where, surprisingly, I thought back to Aliens when the different Marines are basically held in place by the muck from the hive.
Yeah.
And they're held in place, and they become kind of
crystallized in the wall.
Yeah, and they become food or, you know, a host for baby aliens.
So back to the pills real quick, because I think that helped kind of standardize, like, futurism associated with minimalism and pill-taking. Because I'm going to say because the next year, 1969, you would have the Zager and Evans song in the year 2525, which in the year 2525, everything you need is in a pill.
And we're coming up on that.
Yeah, we are. Oh,
wow.
Man, we're going to be living the song. 3 years later, we would get THX-1138 by George Lucas.
I haven't seen it.
I've only seen bits of it. But I know the gist of it, that sex is outlawed and everyone's on pills to function. And then we got our favorite, not necessarily pill-based, but definitely not normal sex-based, but Demolition Man.
Oh, yeah, we were talking about that.
The Demolition Man flat out rips off Barbarella when, you know, Sylvester Stone's like, yo, Sandra Bullock, you want to make out? She's like, okay, here, put this VR headset on and we'll touch hands. She's like, no, that's the one. I mean, that's the entire scene in Demolition Man. But it's basically one of the scenes in Barbarella where she and the resistance guy take the pill and hold hands. That is beat for beat Demolition Man. Also,
dystopic
futures and, you know, things are outlawed and whatnot.
Well, and I think that's probably one of the most erotically charged scene because of the reaction of their hair.
Oh, yeah.
You know, standing up on end, her hair stands up on end, and then it curls up tight, and his hair just kind of stays way up.
Well, it's definitely, you know, cartoony, because I think of, like, the old Looney Tunes cartoons where you'd have the red dressed bombshell that would walk out, and you have that cartoon wolf whose tongue would go aruga and his eyes would pop out.
Yeah,
that's like the cartoon equivalent in the scene in here. Definitely the smoke coming out of the ears. In this case, it's the smoke coming out of the hand.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
You know, you know, that type of thing. Definitely a cartoony scene.
But it's interesting that the real eroticism is when they're engaging in sex in the futuristic way.
Yes. Let's see, anything else on Barbarella? Because I'll bring up the music real quick, because the music is definitely, it's weird for such a psychedelic film. It doesn't have psychedelic music. This isn't like prog rock or you know, something that you would hear from, what's the famous folk musician that I don't like?
Uh-huh.
He's the dad of the guy who sings in the Wallflowers.
Oh, Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan. You know, you don't have like a folksy soundtrack, which would be kind of interesting for a space movie anyway. You don't have a psychedelic soundtrack. You don't have like a Forbidden Planet tonalities type soundtrack. You have like one step away from Dean Martin soundtrack. It is very not jazzy but loungy. It's very relaxed. Have a cocktail. In fact, I would almost say the soundtrack would be fitting for the aforementioned Casino Royale. You know, that kind of, let me put on a dress shirt and tie, go down to the casino, watch some showgirls play baccarat or something. And in this movie, it's like they'll be in space in their shag carpeted cockpit, or they'll be on the planet moving around. And it's this very loungy, have a cocktail type music. And I'm all for that because now I want it on vinyl so I can make a tiki drink to it.
Well, it's interesting that you hit on the lounge aspect of it. So looking at our wonderful Wikipedia, apparently Michelle Magni was commissioned to score Barbarella, but it ended up going to composer-producers Bob Crewe and Charles Fox. And they've been described as lounge or exotica.
Oh, there we go.
So there we go.
Wait, we're saying we're not, this is an Ennio Morricone masterpiece here?
No. But apparently Crewe was known for composing 1960s films or 1960s songs, such as The Four Seasons, Big Girls Don't Cry. I immediately started playing that in my mind.
I did too.
Yep. Okay, don't sing. Some of the music is to the Bob Crewe generation, a group of session musicians who contributed to the soundtrack. Crewe invited the New York-based group to the Glitter House, whom he knew through his production work, to provide vocals for the songs. He reflected on the soundtrack in his autobiography, saying that it, a quote, clearly needed to have a fun and futuristic approach to it with 60s music sensibility, end quote. I think they hit it.
You know who, I think there's only one other person that could have even come close to capable of doing that?
Trevor Sewell.
What? No. I was going to say Lee Hazlewood with the Wrecking Crew studio sessions. Because Lee Hazlewood put a lot of, not necessarily loungy, but, a lot of very 60s spike pop would be a good term for it. I mean, he put out Nancy Sinatra's Boots Are Made for Walking. And I won't sing that for you, I promise.
Okay, thank you.
I don't have a silver tongue for singing. It doesn't stop me, though.
Well, and you know, that goes in line with kind of that retrofuturism that was on the rise during the 60s. And again, you know, the concept of the set designs, the kind of fluid and the round and, you know, round, not sharp corners and things like that, which is interesting because that's really counter to earlier design work. If we're talking about like the avant-garde and you get into the 30s with the very functionalism and things like that, this really counters and goes with the other countered culture type movements of the time.
Well, if you think of like spaceships in the 50s and early 60s, the cockpits on those are blocky, big giant computers and a lot of blank wall space, probably because they didn't have a budget to fill it up with.
Well,
but is this
they could have just gone down to their local carpeteria and gotten shag carpet.
I mean, Barbarella, their solution to that is how do we dress up a dull cockpit? You know, we can't just put instruments everywhere because that's not her type of ship. That's not her bag, baby. It is the shag carpet, but like her cockpit, like is I don't know how to describe this, but I'll describe it as best I can, is like a pit. Her cockpit actually has a shag carpeted pit in it, and her controls are like embedded in the floor, and I'm pantomiming what she's doing. She's not in a chair. She's not like at a computer.
No, she's actually like sort of sitting on the floor, and her panel is really like it looks like piano keys.
Yeah,
and it's kind of curved. It made me think of, Phantom of the Paradise with the Phantom fellow with the keyboard in front of him. It's kind of that idea.
Which we would see again at the end of the film when she's putting Duran's, for lack of a better word, I call it the orgasm piano. Which itself is a piano, but again, one of those, how do you come up with this concept unless you are doing LSD?
I'm doing something. I'm trying to, there was comments about that. I was going to relay that. So in Jane Fonda's remembrance of the film, she said that her and Milo O'Shea, who did the that scene. He was Durant Duran. They were not told ahead of time about all the explosions and sparks and things like that.
Uh-huh.
So they were totally unprepared. So to think that they, you know, did that scene not knowing that you were going to have these various little pyrotechnic things going off, I just find that rather interesting, because we didn't really talk about some of the interesting effects and things that they did.
There's a lot of miniature work. There has to be an instance of very experimental early blue screen here, because when they're in the labyrinth, there's a guy walking around that you can see through him. And it's obviously, you know, he's wearing a blue shirt and there's a blue screen behind him. That's how you execute the effect. But, you know, the blue screen wouldn't come more in vogue until the next decade, you know, led in by Star Wars and whatnot. So I have to think this is a very early mainstream use of blue screen. But other than that, you know, there's strings. You can't have an Italian spaceship movie without strings attached to the spaceship.
Well, yeah, you can see a few strings, but not too many. I still think that the opening striptease is magnificently done, actually, considering that this is, you know, 68. You have a small budget, and your way of doing it is to put glass down and have the camera pointed directly down, and then have Jane Fonda act like she's in zero G's while she's taking her clothes off. I thought that was pretty genius.
But you know, it's the step up from, you know, 5-6 years earlier, because Margaretti and his spaceship films, he was doing zero G work as well, but he was doing it with wires. But, you know, again, ignore the strings. It looks pretty impressive for its time. So, you know, like Barbarella, like the work of Antonio Margheriti, that you know, both Margheriti, you know, he was all about the special effects. And I think that's a good aspect of Italian genre filmmaking, is that fantastique element, be it sci-fi, horror, or fantasy. And I could see, you know, it wasn't directed by Bava or Margaretti or any of those folks, but you could see that influence, that craftsmanship that was hegemonic for the time.
Oh, yeah. I forgot to mention that the comic book writer, artist for this, Barbarella, I'm trying to find his name, Jean-Claude Forest, he was actually worked on the film in the production design and was credited as an artistic consultant. And apparently in an interview that he did many years later, he enjoyed being on the set, but he really was paying attention to the film and what the crew and the director was doing. So, like, he got to see the rushes every day and things like that. And he did say that the choices that were made for the final cut from those images were not the ones that I would have liked, but I wasn't the director. So it's kind of interesting to hear, you know, what the author of the comic book series, you know, thought about the film.
Well, think about this. Barbarella, the comic book creator, in to be part of the production. That's 40 years ahead of Frank Miller being a part of Sin City 300.
That's true.
That would be, I mean, it'd be like Tim Burton bringing in, you know, Bob Kane. I don't know if he's alive at the time. You know, you want to help me make this Batman film. I can't even think of that being heard of.
No, because, I mean, then you get into all sorts of weird things, like in the States, that, you know, who owns the rights, who would be your subject matter expert, you know, would it be the artist necessarily that they'd bring in, or some high executive from DC Comics or something like that for it? You know, we have just a minute or two, and so we can talk a little bit about that, you know, is this a cult film?
It's a cult film because even though it's pervasive in pop culture, it's people remember its influence more than the film itself. And to me, it's like we've used this theory before. It's like the movie King Kong.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone knows what King Kong is. How many people have actually seen King Kong? You've seen the effects of King Kong. You've seen the homages. the parodies, the riffs, the stuff that came after it, the stuff inspired by it, but how many folks have actually sought out in today's market of, you know, with all with the library offerings out there, have you purposely gone out of your way to watch the original King Kong? And mm-hmm. that can be said for a lot of other kind of classic films, but I think Barbarella is the same way, is that it's influential, but it's it hasn't been given the love it needs. Michelle and I mean, I have the DVD of it. She bought it on Blu-ray, mm-hmm. and, like, there's no supplements, no features, no commentaries. There's, like, nothing for this. I mean, it just celebrated its, what, 50-year anniversary?
Yeah.
And there's just the bare-bones DVD release of it. And I'm like, how can you, like, solidify a movie? I mean, it does a pretty good job itself, but where is its external factors to kind of keep the flame going?
Yeah, and the other thing that's kind of interesting is the fact that along with that, you know, one of its kind of lasting impressions would be, you know, if you get sequels and remakes, do you develop any sort of, you know, IP presence after the initial film?
And you mean multiplicities?
Multiplicities. But like you mentioned that there was the crossover comic, and apparently there was a sequel planned back in November of 1968. They wanted to do, it was called, a working title was Barbarella Goes Down, and it would have been, I know, I tried to, like, not say anything about that, with the character having undersea adventures. And then further, more recent, Robert Rodriguez was attached with Rose McGowan to play Barbarella.
Was that the same time he was going to make a Red Sonja film?
Might have been. It was proposed in early 2000s.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Hercules. Writers might have been Neil Purvis and Robert Wade, who had worked on Casino Royale. The deal with Rodriguez actually fell through. Universal didn't want to spend the money on it. Eventually, it went to, as of 2012, there was going to be a pilot that would be written by Purvis and Wade and then directed by Nicholas Winding Refn.
Yeah, he kind of gave us Drive.
Yeah. So he was attached to it up till about 2016 when he was more interested in working on Neon Demon than Barbarella. And, quote, he said, "Certain things are better left untouched. You don't need to remake everything." So that was the last kind of thing about Barbarella.
Well, I learned more about Barbarella than I thought I'd ever know. Thank you.
Well, did you like the film, Hercules, when you watched
it? I liked the film for what it was. It was a cheesy comic book movie. And so I enjoyed it on that level. And it's actually one of my favorite cheesy science fiction movies. It doesn't have like high pretensions of any sort. It just is what it is. And I believe I'd seen it in comic book form before seeing the movie years and years and years ago. So I knew what to expect, and it pretty much delivered.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did you ever see Danger Diabolique? I'm sure you probably have.
No, I have not.
I think we all got homework.
Yeah, we watched it some years ago, and I think it's a better made movie.
Oh yeah.
But it also kind of under delivered, or, you know, under resulted, you know, for profit margins. I just don't think it was there, but I think it was a better made movie.
Well, Hercules, we're down to the last 2 minutes. Do you want us to do so Michelle, where can people find you?
Not
to the last minute.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'll be really fast. MichelleBrittany.com, or you can go to my author page at Amazon. I'm also got a public page on Facebook and an Instagram account.
And I'm at NickDiet.com.
And all of my social media is linked there.
Thank you so very much to the both of you. I enjoyed your conversation and your banter back and forth, and I was amazed at how many facts and strong opinions you fitted into the hour. So thank you for another awesome show. And I look forward to learning more about all your projects, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Until next time, sir. It was good talking with you.
Same here. And thanks to everybody who joined us tonight. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.